Welcome to this Middle East Forum event. My name is Scott Rosenblum, and I'm a board member of the Forum and a partner of Kramer, Levin, Neftalis, and Frankel, co-host of today's briefing by David Schenker. First, a few words about the Middle East Forum, the think tank founded by Daniel Pipes in 1994. The Middle East Forum is devoted to promoting American interests in the Middle East and helping the United States protect itself at home. Some of you have heard this, so if you have, it should serve as a reminder. Others, it's new. Some of the forum's activities include the Washington Project, which monitors and influences U.S. policy in the Middle East, and whose director, Stephen J. Rosen, has written a recent article for Commentary magazine, Encountered an Assault on Jewish Leadership in a Debate on National Public Radio. The Legal Project, which protects free speech about Islam and related topics, and protects writers and researchers from frivolous lawsuits and intimidation. The Campus Watch, which monitors extremism and bias in Middle East studies. Islamist Watch, which monitors nonviolent Islamist activities. The Middle East Quarterly, a policy-oriented journal which provides cutting-edge information on the Middle East, whose editor, Ephraim Karsh, is a leading Middle East historian and who recently published an article in the New York Times explaining why it's in the Palestinians' best interest to make peace with Israel. The Forum's websites have received millions of visits, and I invite you to visit our website, meforum.org, for further information about the Forum's activities. I also hope that you'll consider supporting the Forum financially as a not-for-profit organization with a staff of 18 and a budget of $1.5 million. The Forum relies on tax-deductible contributions, which support a well-managed and lean but highly productive and effective organization. Your contributions will be put to excellent use. As we begin, please switch off all cell phones and pagers. We ask that you hold comments and questions until after the formal presentation ends. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Ziad Abdelnour, our co-host. Ziad Abdelnour is a New York-based financier and venture capitalist who serves as president and CEO of Blackhawk Partners, which specializes in the global energy, general services, and technology sectors. He's the founding member of the Financial Policy Council, a think tank aimed at educating U.S. policymakers on enacting sound fiscal policies. He's a founding member of the Forum's New York Board of Governors. He's a founding member and president of the U.S. Committee for a Free Lebanon, a coalition of Americans of all faiths that educates the public about Lebanon's strategic importance as a U.S. ally and an outpost of Western values in the Middle East. In 2000, Mr. Abdelnour co-authored with Daniel Pipes the book, Ending Syria's Occupation of Lebanon. Combining his financial and foreign policy expertise, Ziad Abdelnour is exceptionally well-versed in Middle Eastern affairs, especially with respect to Lebanon. Please welcome Ziad Abdelnour.
This is one of the best introductions I ever had. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for coming, all of you. The third event I'm sponsoring so far, and I hope this will be one of many. The first one was 2 years ago, where the speaker was Jim Olsey, ex-CIA director. Last year, if you recall, for those who were here, it was David Wormser, who was the aide of Dick Cheney, Vice President Cheney. And now we have the uniquely qualified David Schenker to discuss today's topic, which is why the Obama administration's engagement of Damascus is a very bad idea. David is the Bosnian fellow and director of the program on Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He previously served in the office of the Secretary of Defense as Levant Director, the Pentagon's top aide on the Arab countries of the Levant. He was responsible for advising the secretary and other senior officials at the Pentagon on the military and political affairs of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Jordan. He authored two books. The first one is Dancing with Saddam, the strategic tango of Jordanian-Iraqi relations and Palestinian democracy and governance. And most recently, he published a chapter on U.S.-Lebanese relations in Lebanon. It's called Liberation, Conflict, and Crisis. His writings on Arab affairs have also appeared in a number of prominent scholarly journals and newspapers, including the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the Jerusalem Post. Joining me in welcoming David Shanker.
Good afternoon. President Obama came into office as the anti-Bush. In terms of foreign policy, and perhaps the clearest divergence with President Bush, his predecessor, has been the central plank of the administration's Middle East policy, that is, engaging Syria and Iran. Now, 2 years on, the policy of engaging Iran has been shelved, realizing that Tehran would not be convinced to jettison its nuclear program, the administration turned to sanctions in hope of coercing the theocracy into abandoning its pursuit of nuclear weapons. Arguably, to date, the policy of Syria, engaging Syria, has been even less successful than the administration's policy on Iran. Unlike Iran, though, the administration has not chosen to revise the policy just yet. Now, making Syria policy isn't easy. Indeed, Syria has been a historically tough nut to crack. I know because I worked for 4 years in the Pentagon trying to make Syria policy. You know, one day I was tasked by the secretary. They have these things called snowflakes that Rumsfeld used to send down, these little taskings. And the tasking was to write a memo about how to pressure Syria. And I went to go talk to one of my bosses at the time, Assistant Secretary of Defense Peter Rodman. Peter, who had worked with Kissinger in the Ford and Nixon administration, started chuckling. I said, why is that? You know, why are you laughing? He said, oh, Kissinger asked me to write the same memo back in 1974. How little things change. So it's not easy. Particularly because Syria engages in behavior, a broad range of unhelpful behavior, undermining U.S. interests throughout the region, providing support to Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist groups, providing weapons and other assistance to Hezbollah, the Shiite militia terrorist organization in Lebanon, undermining the pro-West government in Beirut, destabilizing Lebanon, serving as the leading point of entry of jihadis, insurgents entering Iraq, harboring killers of Americans, etc. You get the picture. This is a pretty long list of grievances, and I didn't even mention trying to build a nuclear bomb and ruthlessly repressing its own people. So it's difficult, but I think the problem of finding a good policy on Syria has been exacerbated by the fact that the administration seems to have bought into some of the most fundamental misconceptions about Syria. No matter what Syria does, these misconceptions are never seemingly dispelled. Here's number one on the list. That Syria can be distanced from Iran. They can split Syria off from Iran. The premise, actually the very premise of the Obama administration engagement with Syria is to split Syria off from Iran. The misconception, however, is the belief that this relationship is somehow not a 30-year strategic relationship that's built on mutual interests, in particular a common animosity for Israel and an abiding hope of a decrease of U.S. influence in the Middle East. Rather, so the argument goes, the relationship between Syria and Iran is a marriage of convenience. We hear this all the time. In any event, people say in the administration, Syria would rather be friends with Washington than Iran. It's just not been offered the appropriate incentives. Some people actually believe this stuff. I'll give you a few examples. I'm going to quote one guy here three times, because no matter what Syria does, the point of view doesn't change. So in January 2007, there's this guy, he says, and I quote, Syria, They must be convinced to change course. Engagement with Syria could be useful in advancing our objectives across the region. The challenge is to get Syria's leaders to make a strategic decision to change direction and shift their alliance away from Iran. Okay, a year later, June 2008, the ultimate challenge, moving Syria away from its marriage of convenience with Iran, will certainly not happen overnight. And then March 2009. But I believe, and I think President al-Assad understands, as a secular country with a Sunni Muslim, Sunni minority population, Syria's long-term interests lie not with Iran, but with its Sunni neighbors and with the West. Now, who said all this? John Kerry, right, the head of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. You know, just the last quote in particular, saying that it's not in Syria's interest. The type of hubris that we have to believe that we know best what's in this 30-year dictatorship's interest. They're doing just fine, thank you. Another misconception, that Syria can somehow play a stabilizing role in Lebanon. Let me quote Kerry again here, January 2007. The key to Lebanon's future lies in getting Syria to truly respect Lebanese sovereignty. June 2008, Syria must respect Lebanon's sovereignty and end its deadly meddling. February 2009, Kerry again, we want Syria to respect the political independence of Lebanon. We want Syria to help with the disarmament of Hezbollah. It's unbelievable. Even Secretary of State Clinton, who I think is one of the more sober people in this administration, toes the line on this. Just last month, she met with Syrian Foreign Minister Walid Mualim on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. And according to the State Department readout, this is what they published, they said Secretary Clinton was very clear and direct, both in the context of Lebanon and Iraq, that we discourage any efforts to undermine the stability of either country. Well, I think this train has already left the station, right? Syria has been actively undermining the sovereignty of Lebanon for 30 years. It continues to do so to this very day, despite the fact that their troops disappeared in 2005. In 2007, the Syrian vice president said, we have more influence in Lebanon than we ever did. And this is 2 years after Syrian troops withdrew from Lebanon. All right, the third, and particularly, maybe, well, the third and a particularly damaging misunderstanding, and I think this is particularly pernicious, is that Syria is central to what the U.S. wants to accomplish in the region. This is a mantra that's oftentimes repeated by U.S. officials, so much so that the Assad regime actually believes it. It's led to an unhelpful triumphalism in Damascus. Here's a few examples. Nancy Pelosi, in 2007, she goes to Damascus and she declares that the road to Damascus is the road to peace. And of course, the day after her departure, a dozen pro-democracy activists were arrested in Syria, including a guy named Kamal Lobwani, to 12 years in prison for meeting a U.S. officials during the Bush administration. I knew Lobwani, I met him when he was in Washington right before he returned to Syria and got arrested. Then you have 2009, George Mitchell, special U.S. envoy for peace for President Obama. Syria has an integral role to play in reaching comprehensive peace. This is June 2009. January 2010, John Kerry, Syria is an essential player in bringing peace and stability to the region. April 2010, Kerry visits Damascus and proclaims that Syria is an essential player in bringing peace and stability to the region again. And when he returns, he actually adds, quote unquote, Syria is committed to peace. Well, how does he know this? I mean, the same week that Kerry left, the peace-loving president of Syria, Bashar Assad, advised Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, to end the peace process with Israel and to join the resistance. Right? This is a guy who's committed to peace. So how do we know, in the end, that Syria won't be distanced from Iran, something that Israel, by the way, defines as a sine qua non of any peace agreement with Syria? Well, we know because Syria says so. I just recall earlier in the year, in February, when Assad held this press conference during the infamous terrorist trilateral in Damascus, right, when you had Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, meeting with Ahmadinejad, of Iran and with Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, right? This came one day after, during this meeting, this press conference, Bashar Assad gets up and he ridicules Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who just the day earlier said that said that the United States is hoping to split Syria off from Iran. And in response to that, Bashar Assad announced that they were ending all visa restrictions between Syria and Iran, and that support for the resistance is a moral and national duty in every nation, and also a religious legal duty. Just a few weeks ago, Assad was in Tehran getting an award. He said at that time, he said, Iran and Syria are in the same foxhole and have common objectives. And he also pledged in Iran to expand what he called the axis of resistance. Right? What does resistance, resistance mean? It means attacking Israel, attacking the United States. This isn't really the kind of behavior or kind of rhetoric that one expects from a state looking to improve its relationship with Washington. In any event, it's not going to happen, because the shift away from Tehran and toward the United States implies, I think by definition, an end of Syrian support for terrorism. Right, these guys are a charter member of the list of state sponsors of terrorism from 1979. Right? But this idea that Syria would distance itself somehow from Iran and end its support for terrorism just doesn't jibe with Syria's self-perception. Syria, after all, views itself as a central actor, right? The key state, the pivotal decision-making, most important state in the Middle East. This is how they view themselves, right? Well, what would happen if Syria didn't support Hezbollah? They'd have no influence at all in Lebanon. What would happen if Syria didn't support Hamas? They'd have no influence in Gaza or the West Bank. What would happen if Syria stopped facilitating the movement of jihadi insurgents into Iraq? Syria would have no influence in Iraq. Essentially, without support for terrorism, Syria would have no influence throughout the Middle East. It would be have the foreign policy influence equivalent of Yemen, or maybe Jordan. They'd have no regional influence whatsoever. This is how they view themselves here. They view themselves as key, and they'd be irrelevant largely. They are poor, a weak state, with a terrible economy. If you read the New York Times today, a four-year drought, no oil. This place is not going, not doing quite well. So they're a weak state, and they're nothing without Iran. But what of the hopes that Syria can play a positive role in Lebanon? Syria, with the help of Iran and Hezbollah, has rolled back the Cedar Revolution. This is the people power of 2005, when Lebanese stood up. One out of every three Lebanese went to Beirut and said, Syria and the occupation were fed up, and Syria left. This was the Cedar Revolution. Since then, you've had in Lebanon the only pro-West democratically elected government in the Arab world is in Lebanon. They did this through elections in 2005, and they did it again in 2009. But because of what Syria, along with its partners Iran and Hezbollah, are doing, this election that brought this pro-West government to power has no power at all. Largely, the government is irrelevant in Lebanon, this pro-West government, unfortunately. They've rolled back the Cedar Revolution. And during the 30 years that Syria occupied Lebanon, this was not a period of stability for Lebanon. In fact, I would argue that these were the years when Hezbollah blossomed into the impressive militia that it is today, with 40,000 rockets. Today, Syria is doing even more than it did during those 30 years of occupation to destabilize Lebanon by arming Hezbollah to the teeth. During 2006 war with Israel, we learned just how much Syria was supporting Hezbollah. Now, traditionally, Syria has transshipped weapons from Iran. 747s would take off from Tehran, land in Damascus, weapons would be offloaded on trucks and driven to Bekaa, South Lebanon. Right? This is traditionally how we conceive of arming Hezbollah. But in 2006, we learned that Syria was providing its own top-shelf weaponry to Hezbollah. It wasn't just transshipping Iranian weaponry. It was giving its own Russian weaponry, the Coronet anti-tank weapon. It killed 12 Merkava tanks in Israel that were in Lebanon, and killed a dozen Israeli soldiers. The 220-millimeter anti-personnel rocket that is indigenously produced in Damascus was provided to Hezbollah. One of them hit Haifa train station, killing a dozen Israelis. After the war, Syria rearmed Hezbollah completely, in violation, of course, of UN Security Council Resolution 1701. And today, since 2006, in rearming Hezbollah, What have they done? Even more cutting-edge weaponry. The Scuds that we read about just a few months ago, the Fatah 110, a 250-mile radius Iranian-produced missile that is accurate to within 10 meters. This is the rocket, by the way, the missile that Hezbollah will use to hit the Kiryat in Tel Aviv, the Israeli Ministry of Defense. They provided them with this. Hezbollah has admitted it. Man pads, right? Anti-aircraft weapons that can shoot down F-16s, anti-ship weapons, etc. I could go on. So what's happening during our most recent efforts to engage Damascus? Well, in 2009, the Obama administration tried to work with Syria on border issues. The Syrians had claimed, amazingly, that the border with Iraq, you know, that all these jihadis have gone in to kill Americans and to kill Iraqis and destabilize Iraq, that the border between Syria and Iraq, it's like Mexico. People can just come and go, you know, it's hard to defend it. Of course, you know, during the years when Saddam Hussein was in power, this place was sealed shut. Nobody came or went, right? It's because they viewed it as a threat. This was, in any event, the border was never a problem because all the insurgents were arriving at Damascus Airport. This is not a country where they have freelance political activity or anybody can enter. Hell, I can't get a visa to go to Syria. I tried. Right? These guys very carefully orchestrated this support for the insurgency. Well, anyway, that's what was happening when we were talking with the Syrians on border security. So we're working on the border. Well, the first effort to work with them on border security ended in July 2009, just like a month after it started. What happened? Well, a car bomb exploded in Baghdad, killing 100 people and destroying two ministries. And the Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki, blamed Syria because the car bomb came from Damascus. Well, that ended our talk on border security. And then came the incident I mentioned earlier, right? We just had nominated a guy named Robert Ford to be the U.S. ambassador to Damascus as part of this engagement strategy, you know, that we need to talk to Syria at the highest level, so we need an ambassador. The ambassador had been pulled in 2005 after the Syrians helped to kill the former premier of Lebanon, Rafiq Hariri. Well, just a week or so after this guy, Robert Ford, was nominated, you had this terrorist trilateral in Damascus, where they're laughing at Hillary Clinton about splitting off Syria and Iran. And more recently, our hopes of engaging Syria have been dashed by the reports of the Scud missiles being transferred from Syria to Hezbollah. This also, I think, is what put the ambassador's nomination on permanent hold. He was, you know, put up for nomination months and months ago, and now he's still sitting tight in Washington, awaiting his appointment. This may not happen. And earlier this month, Hillary Clinton met on the sidelines of UNGA with Walid Mualim, the Syrian foreign minister. Now, U.S. officials were actually pretty optimistic after the meeting. They issued some very positive statements saying the meeting went well. And then a day later, Walid Mualim gives an interview to the Wall Street Journal, where he said that if this international tribunal, the special tribunal that is investigating and prosecuting the murderers of Hariri, if it continues, right, and this tribunal, by the way, is just about to indict between 2 and 6 members of Hezbollah for actually pulling the trigger. The orders came from Damascus. Chances are the trigger men were Hezbollah in Lebanon. They're about to indict the trigger men or members of Hezbollah. So Mualim says, if this tribunal keeps on going, there's going to be violence in Lebanon. Right? We're going to support the violence, essentially. So Mualim says you have to end the tribunal. That's one. He also said that Syria would not cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Commission agency, which is investigating the site that Israel bombed in 2007 that turned out to be a North Korean-built nuclear weapons facility. Right? Syria will not cooperate. So they're not cooperating with us. They're trying to end the tribunal. This has not been, in the past 2 years, particularly successful effort at engagement. And I think if you just look at what has happened, I mean, putting aside whether you think Syria is irredeemable, which, by the way, I do, putting that aside, if you just look at what has happened, it's very clear that we are chasing after Syria. and they're having no part of it. And this is not something they're particularly interested in. Now, they like us chasing. There's no doubt about that. They also like, every now and then, to float the idea of peace talks with Israel. Because this deflects all sorts of pressure against Syria. If they're talking to the United States, if they're talking to Israel, if they're even talking about peace with Israel, the international community says, well, not so fast. We really shouldn't pressure them. After all, Syria is a peace partner. We saw this for decades. This has happened. Right? This is not a winning strategy for us to be pursuing this. So sooner or later, hopefully the administration will do what they did with Iran and come to the conclusion that it's fruitless. But until then, I think we're going to be continue to pursue without much luck. In the Q&A, I want to stop here. In the Q&A, I'm happy to talk to you about what's happening on the ground in Lebanon, should you wish to talk about that. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. As many of you know, I'm Joe Skelly, and I'll be moderating the discussion period. And on behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank David Schenker for his comments today, which cast important, if not sobering, light on the situation in Syria and in Lebanon. And I'd also like to recognize the dedication of Mr. Ziad Abdel Nour and the U.S. Committee for a Free Lebanon, whose members are true freedom fighters. We'll begin today first with a question from Ziad, and then we'll go to members of the media.
Thank you, Joe. Look, the question is, when you really think about it, and I've been following this for 20 years, writing about it, analyzing it, what would it take for the U.S. to start being respected by Syria? The U.S. respected by Syria, not Lebanon. The U.S. is not respected by Syria. Syria plays the U.S., plays the Arab world, plays the Lebanese, plays everyone in the whole world, like if they all work for them and they all need them. And they portray themselves as essential to the stability of the Middle East, to the economic prosperity of the Middle East, to their control over Hezbollah, etc. It's a PR game. They're very good at that. And we are really clowns to believe all that circus that's been going on for 20 years, administration after administration. It's not Lebanon that needs to be respected by the U.S., by the Syrians. It's the U.S. What will it take for us to start being respected by Syria? For them to fear us. We're not there to be loved by Syria. We're there in the Middle East to be respected, where our word, the U.S. word in the Middle East, stands when we say something. You know, if you remember back to the Clinton years, Warren Christopher went 16 times to Syria waiting for Hafez Assad. He had him wait for 6 hours to see him. This is a U.S. Secretary of State. Talk about respect. U.S. Secretary of State waiting 6 hours for a senile president to see him. And we took that crap. And we said, fine, no problem. And the liberal press, oh, you know, don't worry, this is diplomacy. This is not diplomacy, this is stupidity. You know, I mean, this is where we stand today. One suggestion I have, you see, the thing is that the more, I mean, and I want to ask David for that, he's the expert, but I give you my opinion here. The thing is that, one suggestion is that, you see, the more we go and approach Syria, quote Syria, the more equal they're going to be. Why not truly isolate them or show them truly what will it, to have them really fearful of our actions, of our unpredictability, and of our actions in the Middle East? What do you think, David?
Yeah, the question about what will it take for the U.S. to be respected by Syria, I think there were a few moments during the Bush administration when Syria actually was quite concerned and feared the United States. It was a brief and fleeting moment, but shortly after, before the invasion of Iraq, the Syrians said publicly, we are going to work against this invasion. And in fact, that was in in France, and I met with a former Syrian vice president, Abdelim Haddam, who had defected, essentially, from the regime. And I asked him, hey, what happened? You know, what kind of agreements did you make about the insurgency? And he said, we went to Iran and made an agreement with agreed with the Iranians that we were going to kill Americans and undermine the U.S. invasion of Iraq any way we could. Well, what happened was the invasion went fairly smoothly, and it was the occupation. But right after the invasion, I think the Syrians were terribly concerned. They were internationally isolated. Bush was not pursuing them. One of the things that actually has happened, particularly after the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, but one of the things the Syrians hate, because they fancy themselves so central and so important, is when they're not afforded this steady stream of diplomatic recognition, European foreign ministers, the steady stream arriving in Damascus or meetings with top-level U.S. officials. But more than that, I think you had several incidents of U.S. hot pursuit into Syria, where we killed insurgents and had issues with Syrians across the border. I think this was very sobering, but unfortunately it was short-lived. But this is the kind of thing, you have to have a robust military policy in addition to a diplomatic strategy that makes it clear that there's more than words and there will be consequences.
Which you think is unlikely to happen with Obama having just received the Nobel Peace Prize
Well, listen, I think that this administration, in any event, even the Bush administration, they're an irritant, right? They didn't rise to the level of, being militarily whacked on a significant basis. I think that's that's cross administrations, Republican or Democrat. We had no problems necessarily in the aftermath of what the Israelis did to the Syrian nuclear facility. In fact, I think one other lever is us going and telling the Syrians that hey, we're not going to constrain Israel. There are a number of things that we can do that doesn't involve kinetic action from us. You're not going to see it under this administration. There's no doubt about that. Although in many ways, the spoiler role that Syria plays as a tool of Iran, it makes it a symptom that is, undermines a great deal of what we're interested in. They can't do anything positive for us, but we can, work toward, undermining them a little bit.
Thank you. Mr. Baumgarten?
Yes.
Yes, do you have a question?
Thank you. I'm curious why you call Syria and I guess with Lebanon a marriage of convenience. Don't you feel on a certain level, certain areas as regards the Shiite community, that they have common interests there? And what do you... I'd like to ask you what you think of Saad Hariri and his capabilities. And I've met him, I've questioned him briefly, and I have an opinion which I'll keep in private.
I don't believe, if you're talking about the marriage of convenience, that's what Senator Kerry said of Iranian-Syrian relations. It's not what I think at all. I think it's a 30-year strategic relationship. What was the marriage of convenience? Was it about that? That's not at all how I viewed it. I'd be opposite, actually, as I thought I expressed. But listen, I think Saad Hariri is, there's an Arabic word that's very similar to the Hebrew. In Hebrew, I think it would be Mizken. Mizken, right? It's the same word in Arabic. Right, so it's the same word, essentially, in Arabic. The guy had his father murdered with Syrian collusion with Hezbollah. And he has a little bit of pride and wanted to be prime minister, like his father did. But by taking the prime ministership, he submitted himself to an untenable position whereby the Saudis, who were his chief backers, and before that the United States, were no longer going to support him and bolster him in the face of Syrian and Iranian and Hezbollah pressure. They weren't going to do this. The Saudis had, I think, realized that the Obama administration is not going to attack Iran, and so they wanted to cut a deal, hedge, and they cut a deal with Syria. Part of that deal also had to do with the premiership in Iraq. They wanted to cooperate on removing Maliki. But the cost for this, the hedging, was essentially Hariri. So the Saudis forced Hariri, who's their guy in Beirut, to go and essentially kiss the ring of the man who ordered the murder of his father. It's a tragedy. I meet Hariri about 3 times a year. I go to Beirut. And listen, I think that he wished things were another way. You know, the smart thing, if I were him, would be to resign from the premiership. He can't do anything positive for his country. It's going to be hard for him to withstand the pressure from Syria and Hezbollah to throw away the tribunal. The Hezbollah wants him to be the premier right now, the prime minister, so they can actually get him to end the tribunal, to say that the tribunal is politicized or to somehow malign the tribunal. This is what they want. I don't think Hariri will do it. In fact, I met him after he became premier, and it had just been announced that Walid Jumblatt, the head of the Druze community in Lebanon, was going to visit Damascus. And Jumblatt said very publicly, he said, like Hariri, he said, "I know who killed my father." It was Hafez Assad. He says, "I know who killed my father, but you still have to do what you got to do." And I said to Hariri, I said, "Hey, Jumblatt said this. He said he knows who killed his father, but he's going to Damascus." And Hariri looked at me, and he had like a tear well up in his eye, and he said, "There's no way in hell I'm going to Damascus." And I don't think he wanted to do it, you know, obviously. But without the support of the United States, without the support of Saudi Arabia, he had no more allies. He got a weak hand. So it's unfortunate.
Yes, and please identify yourself, sir.
Bernard Leventhal. David, is there any opposition group at all in Syria? You know, in Iran, you have a certain amount of people who oppose the regime. They may not have the guns, and they may not deal with foreign policy. But what's the situation in Syria? Is there an intelligent people?
Yeah, they're intelligent, very, very, very talented mercantile class. You know, very entrepreneurial. They have the reputation for being, you know, cutthroat in the Arab world. Businessmen, just amazing businessmen. Listen, I think we know very little about the nature of what's going on in Syria. You know, it's a ruthless dictatorship. We do know that after Bashar Assad came to power, there are many people, including many in the Israeli, you know, military intelligence, who thought this guy was going to be the internet president, right? And he was going to open up. And in fact, he did have a brief opening, what they called Damascus Spring, where they allowed the liberals to come together and hold discussion groups and talk about governance issues and democracy. And Bashar welcomed back all foreign exiles who were, you know, had left Syria under his father. And then he proceeded on arresting all these people who had come back and shutting down these groups and arresting these people. It was, you know, a brief moment where we saw that there was some level of ferment among the elite. You know, that said, the Muslim Brotherhood does not really exist anymore in Syria in any meaningful fashion. Membership is punishable by death. You know, they were treated, you know, ruthlessly in the early 80s, obviously. They moved and are now based in Europe, but are largely, you know, ineffectual. You do have one coherent group of opposition that is quite large, but is on the periphery, which is the Kurds. The Kurds, who live out on the, you know, on the eastern border, essentially, with Iraq, hate the regime. They have risen up, you know, against the regime locally. You know, there was one moment back after the invasion of Iraq where all these Kurds were, you know, famously in a football stadium, and they started shouting out hooray for Bush in Syria on the invasion. But they too are repressed. They have no passports, no identity cards. There are huge Syrian intelligence presence there, and Assad has planted all these Sunni Arab villages around this Kurdish area to try and contain it. They call it like a belt, a Sunni belt. And in fact, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, Assad executed the top religious leader of the Kurds who was visiting Damascus. So, you know, they had him murdered. I'd say that, you know, there's not really an opposition there that is meaningful, unfortunately, now. All the leadership, some of the most respected people are in prison. And there are people who are out there who are putting their lives on the line, but the regime's got a pretty good handle on this. Thanks, Ben.
Yes, Andrew.
Given the...
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Judy Hirschman. The direction of Turkey and what's happening there, is there any really effective way of isolation?
Well, it's certainly become more complicated with the shift of Turkey. I think, you know, this government in Turkey, I don't think there's any real debate about it, is an Islamist regime that is becoming recognized as being increasingly repressive in Turkey, and is undermining the secular nature of the constitution on a daily basis. You know, with Turkey now aligning itself with Syria, having better relations with Iran, diplomatically, certainly it's a little bit more complicated, that Syria has a little bit more outlet, but you know, although they benefit diplomatically from these ties, it hurts them economically. For much of the same reason why the Europeans, I mean, putting the racism aside, much of the reason why the Europeans don't want Turkey in the EU is because they are a manufacturing powerhouse, right? You know, as part of this diplomatic opening, Syria signed a free trade agreement with Turkey, and all the businesses and factories in Syria are now being undercut by the Turks. So this isn't all, you know, a positive relationship. You know, that said, I think, you know, I think it becomes a little bit harder, but the type of diplomats that I'm most concerned about are the European and American diplomats that are showing up there. I'm a little bit less concerned about the Turks.
Yes.
Rafi Marom, if in 2013 we have a Republican president who has a microphone and you are his Middle East advisor, what would you recommend to overthrow the Alawite regime in Damascus?
The question about overthrowing the Alawite. Listen, I think, you know, so now, I'm not sure that I would recommend toppling it unless I knew what was going to come next. And this was, you know, always the thought about, you know, what happens after Assad. This is a, you know, predominantly Sunni Muslim country with a lot of a large Christian population, you know, an Alawite population, some Druze. But, you know, until Iraq is sorted out and emerges, you know, as a stable democratic government, or stable government anyway, I think the last thing the United States wants is another, you know, basically another free-for-all on Israel's border. So I wouldn't recommend that, but I'd recommend, you know, both the diplomatic isolation, the pressure. I would recommend, you know, potentially something along the lines of what we're doing with Iran in terms of sanctions, to try and get really biting sanctions against Syria. You know, we did pass sanctions, but the Bush administration signed into law the Syria Accountability Act. And this had a menu of sanctions, some of which are having an effect on Syria. But largely they're symbolic. And even this administration has tossed some of them out. For example, the list of sanctions don't permit the sale of airplane parts from the United States to Syria. And Syria has two 747s that have been grounded now for a decade. and they need parts. And so the Obama administration, in a goodwill endeavor at goodwill, sold them the parts to let them use these planes. But the problem is, we weren't selling them parts for that because they were transshipping weapons to Hezbollah on these planes. So, now they're back in the air again. This is not, something we should be supporting, I think, at a minimum. But I think we can do a lot more in terms of torquing up the pressure.
Ziad Scali?
Yes.
Sure. I have two questions. Question number one, don't you think we always make mistakes in the Middle East? We invade certain areas like Iraq, Afghanistan, and even we brokered the deal with the PA, and all these countries, all of a sudden, they'll become Islamic country and the law of the land is Islam. What happened to these minorities that's living in these countries? And we are the greatest nation in the world that claims democracy. We go to that part of the world and promote Islamization in their part of the world, so we could really let all the Christians that is living in the area to flee and have no more security. And where do we stand with that? When are we gonna learn that enough is enough? And if we do the same thing with Syria now, who's gonna protect the 13% of Christians that's living in Syria from the first century to now? And how are we gonna protect them? That's the first question. The second question was, what would happen to Syria today if al-Assad would be assassin? I mean, is that going to be a major problem? I'm not saying to do that, but it's an interesting story. But the main thing, as an ICU member and founder, International Christian Union, all I care about from now on, the administration is to learn. Christians are not slaves to be sold and bought and killed at any time when there is no need to. Thank you. Happy to welcome up. And you're welcome.
Well, protecting Christians in the Middle East. By that logic, I mean, one of the places in the Middle East where Christians have it best is Syria. It is a ruthless authoritarian regime, but Christians don't get persecuted there.
I agree with you.
So, because it's a secular regime. So, paradoxically, if you want to protect Christians, what do? You leave Assad in power, right?
At least leave the Alawites in power with the same mentality, and if the Assad is not working, maybe you'll find somebody else within the Alawite community. We can't afford another Islamic Brotherhood in the area. We can't afford another Egypt in the area. I mean, look at Egypt. Our best allies, every day they kill Christians in there.
Nobody opened
their mouth. Even the news doesn't put it on anymore.
Yeah, I know. Our ambassador said that there's no persecution of Christians, Ambassador Scobie. No persecution of Christians in Egypt. It's remarkable.
I think Christians is considered infidels in today's world.
Second part, is unrealistic?
With Assad, the assassination of Assad, and what happens after? So nobody knows. This is all in the family here. Right, you have Assad, you have his sister, you have his brother Mar, right? You have his brother-in-law who's sort of on the outs. But this is what most people think would come next. The problem is, while Assad himself is very glib and I think reckless, Bashar, I think his relatives are probably smarter than he is.
I think we have time for two more brief questions, sir. You had your hand up. Thank you.
Something I wonder about. My name is Alan Margolin. A dictator like Assad and others, I think the most driving force for them is how to stay in power. How do you think they see their own situation?
If I'm Syria and Bashar Assad, I'm flying high. Things couldn't be better.
What does he have to do to stay in power?
Well, let's say he doesn't have to do anything. I mean, he is in power. He's got 15 different security apparatuses that are spying on one another. He's got a population that's been beat down into submission. He once again has a preponderance of influence in Lebanon. He has a 30-year strategic ally that's about to have a nuclear bomb and provide him with a nuclear umbrella. The United States is withdrawing from the region. So his nemesis is gone. Israel, it's not clear if you're Assad that they any longer have the will to do what's necessary to remain in Israel. They didn't perform admirably in 2006. So I think things look great if you're Assad. Couldn't be better.
What a thought that is. And,
also, I might add, this international tribunal investigating Hariri, this works in his favor too right now, because initially all the reports were pointing towards Syria as being culpable for this murder, and now they're focused on Hezbollah. This is not to say they won't ever get to Syria, but I think it's unlikely. So they slipped the noose on this one too. It's perfect.
Sir.
Neil Garano letter. What course of action would you advise Israel to take to contain Syria and Hezbollah?
Israel has long, in the Middle East. I go to Lebanon a couple times, three times a year or so. Spent a lot of time in the region. It's taken for granted that Israel is protecting and supporting the Assad regime in Syria, that they want to keep them in power. That's how it's viewed in the region. Because otherwise, what would explain the fact that after all tangling with Hezbollah throughout the years, Israel never whacked Syria, the people who provide them with the weapons, right? If you want to contain Hezbollah, you can hit Hezbollah, but it's unless you're willing to go all out and go on the ground and occupy Lebanon, I think it's a very difficult road to hoe. You really have to go after the people that are helping Hezbollah, the people that are their patrons, as it were. That's Iran. Now Hezbollah is a symptom, and this all goes back to Iran in the end. And so until something is done about this Iranian support, then you're not going to be able to contain Hezbollah.
And there's a topic for another Middle East briefing. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank our speaker, Mr. Shanker, for his excellent remarks. I'd also like to thank the board members of the Middle East Forum, Mr. Ziad Abdel Noor, and the great committee for Free Lebanon, and all of you for attending this event. Thank you very much.